We are certainly in the midst of what is now called a post-Christian society in this country. And what that means is that Christianity is no longer embraced by the majority of the country around us. Not only are we seeing the jettison of the Judeo-Christian history, but every other nation that is a descendant of Israel, modern-day Israel, is doing so as well. And not only are we seeing a culture that reflects God under attack and being pushed aside, but God himself has become irrelevant, or in the minds of many, even considered to be a myth. Along with this also, in the loss of the understanding, is a truly evil force at work in the world around us named Satan the devil. He is rarely, if ever, talked about, even if God is considered relevant or even marginalized. Satan is not even in the discussion. And so increasingly, even in TV shows and movies, we see Satan is portrayed as the reasonable or misunderstood spirit being, while it is God who is capricious, irrational, or the unreasonable one. In the end, however, Satan is seen like God, simply a mythical being that has been fostered or foisted upon a gullible people to control them. Because the reasoning is that if there is no godliness, if there is no absolute truth, if there is no essential morality, then there is no God, as it is expressed in many ways. And if there is no God, then there is no source of evil. And if those things are true, then each individual decides what is truth, what is good, what is moral. And there is no source of evil in the world, and each individual can decide for themselves, even if there is evil. This is the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, every man deciding for himself. But there are two forces at work in the world in this present age. God, who has allowed Satan to rule this world for a time, and God himself, who has reserved for himself as creator and originator of all life, the right, if you will, to work with a select few during this present age to eventually show the world that he has always been working his plan of salvation. Let's begin today in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 4. In this, we see an expression regarding Satan that not only does most of the world not know, but is missed even by many who claim the title of Christian. In 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4, it simply says, "Whose mind," speaking of those who do not have God's Spirit revealing his truth to them, "but whose minds the God of this age has blinded, who do not believe, lest the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is in the image of God, should shine on them." The God of this age, the English word there, sometimes is translated world. The Greek word is aeon, and it means an age or period of time, not eternity, a period of time. We get our English word eon from this Greek word. But we find in this verse that God has allowed Satan rulership over this present world age. This is why Satan could tempt Christ with rulership. Let's look at that in Luke chapter 4. This is an interesting event. I won't say story, it's not a story in the classic sense, but an event that was recorded. Another one of those sections of Scripture, I wish we had more. Roxanne and I were even talking about this coming down. Do you think Satan thought that since Christ was now human, not spirit, God, that perhaps he could sway Christ? I mean, this was the being, Christ was the being who created Satan. And yet, look at what he's offering him. So Luke 4 and verse 6, Satan, the devil, says to him, "All this authority I will give to you." He's taken him up to a high mountain. He's showing him all the kingdoms of the world, the systems, if you will. And he's essentially said to Christ here, "I'll give you all of this if you will worship before me." And again, it's quite a statement to make. I don't know how many people truly understand the truth of the matter. If it was not Satan's to make, if it was not his to give, then Christ could have called him a liar here. But he didn't, did he? It was his to give, if you will, at least for a time. Christ knew that Satan's rulership would be for a limited time. Perhaps that was why there was really no draw to that. Christ knew the timing of it all. He knew he created it all. He knew where it would lead to in God's plan of salvation. And ultimately, the bottom line is that he knew only God should be worshipped. He even says that here in verse 8, "Get behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the eternal your God, and him only shall you serve." But Satan is a deceiver, isn't he? He didn't tell Adam and Eve the truth in the garden. Maybe Satan didn't even know the truth to the extent that we understand it. But when he said, "You shall not die," perhaps he knew they wouldn't die right away. But they did die, didn't they? He said you could be gods. Well, no, not really, not in the sense of the meaning of the word. We can claim ourselves to be God in choosing, but that doesn't make us anything that can control anything else. But even in mankind's recorded history, Satan's not been honest with any of what he has promoted. But let's look at Matthew 24 next. This matter of deception is at the core of who Satan is. In Matthew 24, we have here in this chapter, especially the beginning half or so, Christ answering the question from the disciples about what the end time would look like. And so Christ lays out many of the things that will take place, the cautions and the warnings, if you will, along with that. But in verse 4, as Christ begins to answer them, I've always found this very interesting. He's not talking about prophecy. He's not talking about history. He's not talking about man's rulership or anything along that line. He simply says here, "Take heed that no one deceives you." That's where it all begins in being prepared. That's where it all begins in knowing how to fight Satan, the devil. Because the word deceive here in the Greek means to lead astray. Satan has deceived mankind into believing all manner of false doctrine, even to the point of deceiving mankind that God and even Satan don't exist. But Satan works in the mind of mankind, this deception, to broadcast his thoughts and his attitudes. Let's look at that next in Ephesians chapter 2. We should understand this illustration perhaps better than anyone else in mankind's history because we're surrounded with radio waves. I mentioned this in the sermon last week. We have cell phones. Almost every one of us have cell phones. Well, that's a radio wave. It's a certain spectrum on the radio spectrum. You've got TV signals. You have police band. You have emergency frequencies. You have CB. You have regular radio. Ephesians 2 and verse 2 here, talking about our trespasses and sins in the past. He says, "In which you once walked according to the course of this world." Notice, "according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience." The power of the air. That can be frightening in some ways, but in other ways it should give us a great deal of understanding as to Satan's limitations. I'll come back to that thought here in a little while. But Satan was cast down, we know as well, from serving at God's very throne. He is allowed to have this power and influence, if you will, over this age for a time, but he will not rule over earth forever. The title of my sermon today is simply Satan's Fate. What is the fate of the demons who follow him? What is the fate of Satan ultimately as God brings to fulfillment all that he has in his plan of salvation? We're here on this Day of Atonement, a day that pictures the removal of Satan from the affairs of mankind to the return of Jesus Christ. And so we're going to look at the answers to these questions here today. Let's go to Ezekiel 28 next. The false Christian belief that Satan and God are locked in this war over the souls of men is not only wrong, it isn't even close to the truth of God. Because if it is the case, then Satan is winning big time, isn't he? It shows God is a very weak God, if this is the case. But in Ezekiel 28, we're given a glimpse behind the curtain, if you will. And God uses here the example of the king of Tyre. And what we're discussing or reading here is essentially the power behind the throne, that Satan is the one who has stirred these things up in mankind's history down through time. So in Ezekiel 28 and verse 12, it says here, "The son of man, take up the lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the eternal God, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty." which is why we know it's not talking about a man. There are a lot of people who have thought they were the sum of wisdom and perfection, but they're human. They don't fulfill this. Verse 13 clinches it because it says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. Satan, as he was created and known as Lucifer at that time, was an extremely, if we can use the word, beautiful being. But let's move to verse 13. It says, verse 15. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. He's not God. He does not have the power of God. He does not exist in time as God does. He was created perfect, it says, till iniquity was found in him. We oftentimes say in church that iniquity is sin, and it is. But there's a deeper meaning here. Some translations have wickedness. You were perfect until wickedness was found in you. And that gives us a little bit better understanding, but the primary meaning of the word here in the Hebrew means moral evil. So Satan became morally or grossly unfair, that's another meaning of the word, in behavior. He was created, as we just read here, full of wisdom and beauty. But Satan rejected what God made him to be, and rather became filled with immoral and grossly and perverse behavior. That's another one of those questions I have on my list to ask God. What was it that changed him? What was it he allowed himself to begin to focus on that took him away from God? Whatever it was, it removed him from God's presence on a regular basis. Let's look at that in Isaiah 14. Isaiah 14 and in verse 12, how you are fallen from heaven, O son of the morning. Now we know, at least for now, Satan does still have access to God's throne. The beginning of the book of Job shows us the sons of God, as the angels are also called, came before God's presence. Satan was there. So we know that he's not removed completely from God's presence, but he is no longer the cherub angel that covers. He's no longer Lucifer. He's now Satan. So he says, I know how you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning, how you were cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. There's a view in the world around us that religion has been a millstone around the neck of humanity. I have the opposite view, and more specifically, that God's way of life has actually been the saving grace of mankind's history. If it had not been for God's course corrections along the way, we wouldn't have made it out of the first 2,000 years of mankind's existence. It was so evil. But to continue here, it says, for you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. He no longer has the right to come just whenever he wants and to do whatever, but he's claiming here that he will. I don't care what God says. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. Now, he lost this, didn't he? Through his grossly and unfair and perverse behavior. He says, I will also sit on the mount of the congregation, the farthest sides of the north. This is God's throne. He says, I'm going to kick God off his throne. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Going back to verse 12, the word fallen literally means here to be cast down, to fall away, or to have lost. And that's interesting as we understand what becomes of Satan and his relationship, if you will, as it stands with God now. But we also see in this a matter of judgment. God determined this was unacceptable. He made a judgment. But judgment taught by nominal Christianity says that judgment is a singular moment. So to ask a question we can't answer, it's always interesting to think about some of these things. How long was it between when Satan began to move from being Lucifer until he became Satan? How long a time passed? We have no idea. What was even time like then? Was there time? But I have to imagine that God had a conversation with him, probably more than one. if you go down this path, this is what will happen. Because judgment by God is actually a collection of observations and discernment over time as to how an individual lives or doesn't live according to his law. Now the question is, when does God start looking at that? At the very least, he begins at our baptism. He wants to see what we will do with his Holy Spirit. He's already determined the Satan and the demons don't want to live his way of life. They've made that choice already. But in the prehistory, before mankind existed, Satan showed God that he didn't want what God had. He changed his nature. Satan perverted his thinking, as we read here, to the point where he affected not just himself, but a third of the angels. Let's look at that in Revelation chapter 12. So he had great influence, probably a whisper campaign, among other things, much like he did with Adam and Eve. God wasn't telling them the whole truth, that he wasn't being fair, that perhaps as they saw, God began to implement or even put into motion his plan of salvation, that mankind would become part of his family, something the angels will never have. But maybe Satan got angry over that. Whatever the case was, he spread his iniquity. In Revelation 12, verse 4, it says, he drew a third of the stars of heaven with him. This section in Revelation is talking specifically about Satan now no longer having any access to God's throne. But we know here from this verse that a third of the angelic realm followed Satan, and so they became corrupted like him. In Luke 10, verse 18, we're given a word illustration, if you will, of what this looked like when Satan rebelled. If we can call it dramatic, it was very dramatic. Luke 10 and verse 18, Christ here says, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. He made this statement to the disciples because they were impressed. They had been given authority by Christ to go out and do various things, healing certainly, but even casting out the demons. And they were impressed. They were stunned probably, because who are they? But it wasn't just that they were men. It's that they were men who had been given authority by the Creator of all. And Christ gives us another insight, if you will, into this prehistory where he says, saw Satan fall like lightning. The power, if you will, that takes place just in that moment. But Christ saw Satan go through this process. And in the corruption of Satan then came the lusting for more power and more authority, as we read in Isaiah 14. This is a lesson of character development. This is the reminder even in this day to afflict our souls, to remember in the right way who we are and what our place is with God. And the really crazy thing is that once we understand that and actually act that way, then God gives us everything because he knows what we'll do with it. Character is simply the matter of choosing between right and wrong. You can create bad character. You can create good character. To create good character, then you choose the right more than the wrong. But in choosing to reject God's way of life, Satan rebelled. And in that rebellion, he sought to destroy everything that he could that God had created. Even in that mind, to think that he had the ability to do that. But this is where we come to in Genesis 1, verse 2. Why did God have to reshape the world? Because Satan had sought to destroy it. And as much as mankind presses into viewing the deep reaches of the universe around us, we see nothing that supports life. It's awesome. The power, the scale, the sheer existence of the things that are out there. But there's no life beyond this planet. So Genesis 1, verse 2, it says, the earth was without form and void. Darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Without form and void. The word was here that's in most translations, the earth was without form, is translated in the majority of translations that way, but the Hebrew word is hayah, H-A-Y-A-H, and it better means to become. The earth became without form and void. And so we have the first worldwide flood here. The second was during Noah's time. But the earth was covered with water. There was nothing else. Life couldn't be supported in that. So then the balance of Genesis 1 and 2 here, God sets that right so that mankind and the other life that he's going to create can exist on this planet. We know this was not God's original intent from Isaiah 45 and verse 18. In Isaiah 45 verse 18, we have just one verse here that makes a connection that most miss, where it simply says, "Thus says the Eternal who created the heavens, who is God, who formed the earth and made it, who established it, who did not create it in vain." That word vain is the same in Genesis 1, 2. He did not create it in confusion, in waste. We know from Job, the end of the book of Job, it says the angels shouted for joy when they saw what God had created. I can't imagine shouting for joy over seeing a ball of water. But to see it as it existed, even with the Garden of Eden, and to know that probably wasn't even what it looked like before. The awesomeness of God's majesty and power, and creative ability, and knowing what would move forward from it. But God didn't create it, waste it. And we know from 1 Corinthians 14, verse 33, it says that God is not the author of confusion. This waste that was initially there. So then when God created Adam west of the Garden of Eden, Satan was already there. He pretended to be a light bringer. That was his original name, right? The morning star. But he was now an evil spirit, and Christ called him a liar in John 8, verse 44. He is a liar and a murderer. There's no truth in him, he said. He lied to Adam and Eve to tempt them to sin, didn't he? And in that lie, he also killed them. This is Satan. This is his attitude. He lied to them, as I said, about not dying. He hence then taught the very first heresy that mankind has embraced, and that is that they have an immortal soul. But as Christ said, Satan fell from heaven. And so the false teaching he promotes as well is that mankind equally fell from heaven. How many times have you been to a funeral and they talk about, well, now so-and-so has gone back home? No, he was never there. But Satan no longer has the right to live in heaven, so he falsely promotes that mankind will live in heaven. But as we read in 2 Corinthians 4, 4, he has rulership presently over this age and over the angels that rebelled with him that are now called demons. Let's look at Matthew 12. He does have rulership. He does have authority that God has allowed for now. But that won't always be the case, as we'll see as we progress through this. But in Matthew 12 and in verse 24, Christ regularly in his ministry, earthly ministry, cast out demons from individuals. And ironically, the Pharisees then said, well, he can only do that because he has power from Satan, which doesn't really make sense. You'd think he would have the power to do more of that possession, not less of it. But nonetheless, this is what the Pharisees say. Matthew 12 and verse 24, when the Pharisees heard this casting out, he said, "This fellow does not cast out demons except by Beelzebub, the ruler of the demons." The word here in the Greek that is ruler can also mean prince. So some translations will say prince. But by its definition, what it technically means is first by order. Satan is above all other demons. He has more power than all others. But again, he does have this authority, but only by what God allows. The demons, likewise, can only interact with mankind as much as God allows or as much as an individual allows. So we don't have to fear them in that way. In fact, we have authority to cast them out in Christ's name. But this is the danger of dabbling in the demonic world or breaking down the natural barrier that God has given mankind in their mind. If that happens enough, then they can allow demonic influence. And I've often wondered in going through the gospel accounts how prevalent that demonic possession was in that first century. It seemed to be a pretty big issue. And we think that it's not in the world around us, but I have to think that it is. When I see how people behave, what they value, and just the sheer immorality that is replete around us. Let's go to 1 Peter 5 next. Satan's purpose, to be clear, his goal, if you will, of his existence is to destroy mankind. He has tried to destroy God's creation. And so if he can't do that, he'll do the next best thing. He does not want anyone to have what God is offering. But Satan is not God. He's not omnipresent. He can only utilize the natural pulls. And so this is why he has to broadcast. He can't be everywhere. He doesn't have that ability. But he can utilize the natural pulls of human nature. And what he does is magnify that carnal nature, those pulls of the flesh that we read of that he can magnify and broadcast in Ephesians 2. But in 1 Peter 5, verse 8, we find something else here about Satan. It says, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Now, what is one of the primary aspects, characteristics of a lion? They're an opportunistic hunter. Right, so they're watching. When they get hungry and they decide it's time to have a meal, they start watching, don't they? And they watch not for the strong, not for the quick. The ones that are too far away, they ignore. They're looking for the opportunity of somebody who is not vigilant, not paying attention, not careful. So he's a predator of opportunity. He cannot make us do anything. Some of you remember, I think it was from the late 70s, there was a sitcom, one of the catchphrases of the individual was, "The devil made me do it." No, the devil doesn't make us do anything. He influences us, but he can't make us do anything. That's the aspect of our character being developed. But what we find is God's nature is different wholeheartedly. So let's look at 2 Peter 3 in verse 9. 2 Peter 3 verse 9 says, "The Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some count slackness, but is long-suffering towards us." We should be eternally grateful for that. He is way more patient than we would be. And that's to our benefit because it gives us opportunity to change, doesn't it? To eventually see what the problem is, because oftentimes, almost always, we fail to see the problem right off the bat. We think we're justified, we think we're right, we think we're okay with God, whatever it happens to be. But in his patience here, he's working with us. And notice why, the end of verse 9, because he's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Satan wants the exact opposite. He wants to see all of mankind gone and having no opportunity to be in God's family. God is exactly the opposite. He is not willing, it says here, that any should perish. Because he started all of this exactly for that reason, didn't he? For mankind to be in his family. And so we have references in Romans 11:32, where it talks about how he has mercy on all, even those presently without his spirit. Look at how awful Hurricane Ivan should have been. The destruction that went through Florida, they don't even know the cost yet. But in the scheme of things, the relatively small amount of loss of life was just astounding. Hebrews 2:10 talks about his desire to bring many sons to glory. And all that God does to make that happen, how patient and merciful he's been for the last 6,000 years. But let's begin to answer the question more directly and go to Revelation 20. What is the fate of Satan? Revelation 20, we have here in the timing of God's plan of salvation. Feast of Trumpets has come to pass. Christ has returned. The Day of Atonement has come to pass, and now this is what happens. John writes here in vision, I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. See, Satan doesn't have all power. I don't know what kind of chain this is, but it's a chain that can chain spirit. And this angel comes, and it says, verse 2, he laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So in John's vision, Feast of Tabernacles fulfillment has not yet started. This is at the beginning of it. Satan is not on the scene when Christ reestablishes his throne, when God begins to work through his Son with mankind to show him what's possible. So verse 3, this angel then cast him, Satan, into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him that he should deceive the nations no more. Remember Matthew 24, verse 4? That deception, whole cloth that's broadcast to the world is no longer there. Till the 1,000 years were finished, why would he be released at all after this? Well, you're going to have individuals that are born in the millennium that have never seen Satan's world. Everybody makes the same choice, don't they? Which tree will you eat of? The tree of life or the tree of knowledge of good and evil? One represents God's way of life, the other represents Satan's. And so he will be released, it says at the end there, for a little while. Some translations have here a bottomless pit in verse 1. Some have simply abyss. And abyss is more true to the Greek word. It does mean bottomless, but it means also unbounded. It has no definition, and it's immeasurable. The closest I can come to this in my mind is shortly after high school, over the summer I graduated, I had a friend in high school who had a grandmother that lived down in northern Kentucky. And northern Kentucky is riddled with caves. Limestone area, this is where, now that I want to say, the Mammoth Cave. This is where Mammoth Cave is, and there are caves all over northern Kentucky there. So we're at his grandmother's property, and she has all these caves. We decided we'd go explore some of these caves. Some of them were very short, probably only 20 yards or so. You'd find the back of it. But some we never got to the end of. We just took flashlights. We went in. In one cave, we were far enough back. I don't know how far back we were. Far enough back that when we turned off our flashlight, there was nothing. We couldn't see any light. There's no sense of anything because there's nothing to hear. There's nothing to smell. It's just blackness. I couldn't even sense my hand in front of my face. This is what I imagine as far as this abyss, as it says here, because that's what the Greek talks about, this bottomless aspect, unbounded, immeasurable. Let's go to Matthew 25. Can you imagine being restrained in such a place for 1,000 years? There are some that will say, well, why would God do that? A loving God wouldn't do that. Well, but we don't know the conversation that God had with Lucifer and the angels before they rebelled. What if, this is speculation, so don't put a lot into this, but what if, and I don't see it outside the realm of possibility either, but what if he said to Lucifer and the angels, if you go down this path, because you are spirit, this is what you will have. Then it is fair, isn't it? Because they knew up front. But in Matthew 25 and verse 41 here, this is in context Christ when he returns to judge the nations. In fulfillment of time, some of this will happen at the beginning of the millennial time period. When he returns, there'll be some judgment. I'll come back to that as well in a moment. But primarily, this is talking about the last great day, mankind knowing what they're being judged against. But notice he says, he will say to those on the left hand, the goats, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. Now, the book of Revelation calls this the lake of fire. We'll look at that here in just a moment. But what good does it do to throw an eternal being into a physical fire? It doesn't do anything. Physical can't touch spirit. The physical beings thrown there are ash. We know of that from Malachi 4, verse 3. It says, the righteous, the ashes of the unrepentant will be under their feet. So fire, by its definition, is a physical chemical process. You have matter, you put enough heat to it, you give it enough oxygen, it will combust. That's the expression, right? Any machine is a smoke machine if you push it hard enough. Some of you know what I'm referring to there. But anything physical is burned up. The Hebrew word here for everlasting, the everlasting fire prepared for the devil. The everlasting there in the Greek, sorry, not Hebrew, means perpetual or eternal. And so this is where many get the doctrine of heaven and hell as a support. But that's perpetual isn't what it means there. What it means is age-lasting. Perpetual in the sense that it will not be extinguished for a period of time. Nothing can extinguish it. Some few translations have age-lasting fire. That's more accurate. But we also know that God uses this fire to consume the incorrigible. As I said, the beast and the false prophet are thrown into this fire at the beginning of the millennium, after Christ returns. Let's look at this in Revelation 20. Revelation 20 is where we were earlier. It talks about Satan being restrained. Then after the 1,000 years before the end of that, the little while that he's released comes to pass, and then he's removed. Then we have what's called the Great White Throne Judgment, what we call the last great day, what Leviticus 23 calls the eighth day. And so Revelation 20 and verse 10 says, the devil who delivered or deceived them, we're back to this matter of deception, aren't we? Was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet should be, were. The word are there is not in the Greek. So in the context, we have to make the understanding. For those that believe in an eternal punishment in fire, that's why the word is are here. But are is not accurate because the beast and the false prophet are cast into the fire at the beginning of the millennium. They're physical. They've been ash for 1,000 years. They don't exist anymore. So again, what is the point here? Well, this is the same fire spoken of in Matthew 25, verse 41. It lasts through the millennium. It is also an object lesson for those that are in the millennium. This is the fate. It will be there for those that come out of the second resurrection as a reminder as well. But let's look at 2 Peter 2. For now, even though Satan does have some authority, we know from Scripture that he's limited as well, as I mentioned, and this is another example of this. We don't think of Satan as being restrained, but even now he is restrained, certainly restrained by what he can do, what God will allow. The example of Job is another great example, right? Satan said, well, Job is only doing this because of X. And God says, okay, well, you can take that away, but nothing else. You can go this far, but nothing else. You can't hurt his life. You can't take his life. So Satan is limited, but even in the sense of their existence in the universe, in 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, It says, for if God did not spare the angels who sinned, they are angels. We simply call them demons now because they've changed their character. But notice, if he did not spare them, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. We're back to this matter of darkness as well. But he has restrained the demons, the sinning angels, on earth until the time of their judgment comes, meaning the time of the execution of their judgment. It's already been determined. Let's look at Revelation again, 21 this time. Revelation 21, verse 27. After God's plan of salvation is fulfilled, trumpets comes and goes, Christ is on the scene, atonement comes and goes, Satan's removed for 1,000 years, Feast of Tabernacles comes and goes, but at the end of that, Satan's released for the short time, and then the last great day comes and goes. This is Revelation 21 then, verse 27. It says, there shall be by no means enter into it. This is God's new heaven, new earth. They shall by no means enter it into anything that defiles or causes an abomination or a lie, but only those written in the Lamb's book of life. Nothing will be there that's profane, that's an abomination or a lie, which means Satan and his demons will not be in the New Jerusalem. So where will they be? Well, let's look at Luke 20. Luke 20 gives us another insight, not only into Satan and the demons' existence, but our future existence. In the context here of this chapter, Christ is being questioned, as he was a number of different times, and they're trying to pose these questions, hoping to trip him up on something they could say, aha, I can tell you're not the teacher. But in Luke 20 and in verse 34, Christ answers here then, because they gave the ridiculous scenario of the woman married 7 times. So they said, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? He says, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. It's been given to mankind. But those who are counted worthy to attain that age, the age to come, he says, and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage. It's no longer necessary. What does marriage picture? Ephesians 5. It pictures our relationship with Christ. The oneness in our physical marriage should represent the spiritual oneness in our relationship with Christ. We'll be spirit. We'll be with Christ. We don't have to picture that anymore. So he says, verse 36, nor can they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. We are spirit beings. So it says they cannot die. Well, then how do we answer the question of Ezekiel 28? I didn't read this earlier. When it speaks to this illustration of Satan in this lamentation of the king of Tyre, but in verse 16, it says, by the abundance, speaking again of Satan, by the abundance of your trading you became filled with violence within and you sinned. Therefore I cast you out as a profane thing out of the mountain of God. We read that, Jesus' account. I saw Satan fall like lightning. I destroyed you, O covering cherub, in the midst of the firing stones. What does the word destroy here mean? It means to wander away, to lose oneself. God will lose Satan. That's his fate. Satan will wander away. He will not be destroyed. Christ tells us the angels don't die. But he will be destroyed from God's presence. No more. For henceforth, forevermore, he will no longer have access to not only God, but to mankind. Let's look at Jude, verse 6. Jude verse 6, it says, the angels who did not keep their proper domain. And this gives us a hint of what happened before Genesis 1-2, that God had given them authority over His creation, probably specifically this earth, in whatever form or fashion that looked like, but they didn't keep it. They decided it wasn't enough or whatever. It says it didn't keep their proper domain, but left their own abode where God placed them. He reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of that great day. They left their domain. And we see here that it's reserved for them to be in darkness. Let's go to Revelation 20 next. I mentioned that blackness of the cave. And I've been in a number of prisons over my years as a pastor especially. And prisons, as they are implemented in this country, are awful places. They're better than most of the rest of the world. But they don't really solve the problem. They don't change the behavior. In fact, even here in the state of Wisconsin, from the time I came here until now, they've gutted the education programs. There's almost no education within the prison systems. So how can they change? Even counseling resources have been decimated. So they just sit. But one of the worst things in the prison system is if they can put somebody in what's called solitary. It's your own little cell, but you have no interaction with anybody else. The only time you probably see another person is when they hand you your food for whatever meal. There's no rec time to be outside, to have the sunshine, to exercise. In a lot of cases, they even restrict whatever reading material. You have none of your own personal items. So any of your own books or anything else that you've collected or been able to have, none of that. You sit alone in a cell for 24 hours. It's one of the most awful punishments because there's no human interaction. This is the closest I come to this blackness that's talked about in Scripture. But Revelation 20 and verse 10, to read it again, it says they will be tormented day and night forever. The they here talking about, they will be tormented, are not, again, talking about the beast and the false prophet because they're ash. The they is Satan, and by extension, the demons who followed him. They will be tormented day and night forever because there's nothing else. And I can only imagine how angry and violent that existence will be, because all they have is each other. And they're all angry and violent, aren't they? Satan is the goat of Leviticus 16, led into the wilderness. The responsibility, the price that he brought sin into God's existence is placed back on him. He's removed into the wilderness forever. No longer able to try and overthrow God's purpose. No longer able to influence mankind into sinning and rebelling against God. And so what we find in Satan's fate is that he will be held accountable for his role in the sin and the rebellion of the world. We have our own accountability. This is us being humbled before God. This is us coming to the knowledge and understanding we need to accept the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. This is us allowing God's Spirit, pictured in Pentecost, flow in us, through us, to change us, to become like Him. We have our accountability, and if we don't accept any of that, it's death, isn't it? Eternal death. Satan has his accountability as well. He would be held accountable for his rebellion against God and the pain and destruction that he has brought into God's creation. He'll be removed from influencing mankind for 1,000 years after the return of Christ, and then forever at the end of the millennium. God's plan of salvation will continue to unfold after this day is fulfilled in God's plan. After the fulfillment of this day of atonement, mankind will continue to have the opportunity to be in God's family. May God speed the day of this fulfillment.